Hello! Sorry we missed you last week. Not that sorry, but welcome to Season 2, Episode 2 of Infield Chatter. I am your usual host, Charlie Gibo, or Clefo if you want. I'm joined in Las Vegas, Nevada by Devin Jessup. Say hi, Devin.
Hi, Devin.
Best of the business, folks. Also joining us from Scottsdale, in a hoity-toity part of Scottsdale, as opposed to, you know, those slums and burnt-out buildings of Scottsdale.
True.
We've got Soko. Say hi, or not.
Hi, or not.
And that's not all for this week. Yes, for the first time ever, we actually have a guest here who has foolishly agreed to come on to this podcast. We should have more. We have Nicholas Stellini, who is a writer for Beyond the Boxscore at SB Nation. You should check them out. Anytime there's a Diamondbacks-related article, it's front page to the pit by someone, so there's that. He also writes for Baseball Prospectus Brox and FanRag. Nick, thanks for coming on.
I'm the first guest. You didn't tell me that.
Oh. We meant to have guests last year, but I think there was a point in the middle of the season where it was just I could try, but I also have stuff to do.
We're all talk.
We also meant to get on iTunes at one point, but
I completely feel you there. We want to get our podcast on iTunes at some point too, but you know.
Oh yeah. I should give you a plug for your podcast. What's his full title again?
Beers, Doubles, and Drunks.
Beers, Doubles, and Drunks. And I have this is a topic we could kind of get into. One of your fellow podcast hosts on that one. Blew up the Milwaukee Brewers shit, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, I am also on this podcast with Zach Moser of VP Wrigleyville and the one and only Travis Sarandos of VP Milwaukee and Brew Crew Ball, where the Justice for Hank movement was started by him, and I'm sure you've all heard about that and read about it by now.
If you haven't, I'll just give a very brief synopsis. Basically, you may remember 2014, right?
Yeah.
The Brewers found a dog around their spring training facility, and they named it Hank, because, you know, Hank Aaron, associated with Milwaukee, makes sense. Flash forward to now, and Travis wrote an article on Monday, which was tongue kind of in cheek,
it's like half satire, but I've just been able to get a fully straight answer out of him about how much it's satire. I think that's by design. That's just kind of his
Yeah. Basically, the theory is that Hank, the dog, has either died or been replaced by an imposter, mostly based on pictures of Hank from, you know, a few years ago to pictures of Hank now. It's gotten to the point where Brewers beat writers are getting very, very annoyed, to be a little understated, about it, and the team hasn't actually said anything. That's a press conference tomorrow to address this.
I don't know who it was who put out a statement for the Brewers, but there was no denial in that statement.
It was like the tooth fairy's real.
Yeah, exactly. It was like half a step away from saying that Hank lives in all of us.
Hank the brew dog died for our sins.
You killed him.
In 3 days, he will rise again. Kibbles for all.
I want the Brewers just to come out to the press conference tomorrow with a completely different breed of dog and be like, no, this is Hank. What are you talking about? It might not even be a dog. Bring out a parrot. This is Hank. I don't know what you're making such a fuss over.
Bring out Bernie Brewer.
It's just taken hold in such a way where it's I'm sure the three of us who write for the Snake Pit Kids say, thank God the team hasn't gotten wind of certain things we've written, because...
Oh, man.
Yeah. To be fair, they did confirm one of our conspiracies, so... I guess that...
Oh, right. The turtle one, yes.
Did they confirm?
They did confirm. When they were talking about the new uniforms, I asked them straight up if they were going to return to their turtle roots. And they said that I guessed correctly. And I'm sure they were not being sarcastic.
Absolutely sincere.
Well, yeah, you should look that up, because it's a sort of fun, harmless story that may or may not involve the death of an animal. So, you know. But yeah, the article's still up on Brew Crew Ball, .. for now.
I feel like the black helicopters that we have referenced coming to take away people discussing the Darren Sutton conspiracies may be circling over.
Darren Sutton, before he was announcer for the Diamondbacks,
was with the Brewers.
How deep does this go?
Oh my god.
Like the black helicopters at the end of Goodfellas.
Oh yeah, yeah. Okay, grab the dog, leave the cannoli, blah blah blah.
Wear a polo shirt.
Wear a polo shirt, yeah. But so yeah, check that out, because like I said, it's interesting. I'll just say interesting. And it's destroying journalism as we know it, according to one Brewers beat writer.
Can we start a Henry Gate? It's about ethics in dog based dog related baseball journalism.
That's going down a dark path that I didn't intend it. I'm so sorry. One of the reasons I wanted guests on here finally, now that, you know, this time last year my sphere of baseball writer Twitter influence was like just you guys, but I kind of want to get, you know, different perspectives on the Diamondbacks to a certain extent, and you know, all these writers, they have their own favorite teams or teams they follow, and especially during spring training, you might not be aware too much of how, say, Team X is or what they did in the offseason or that kind of thing. So I think, you know, it'd be fun to sort of enlighten the general populace on that. So on our last episode 2 weeks ago, we kind of discussed the Diamondbacks offseason, you know, from the Greinke's signing to, you know, the Dave Stewart takes mescaline period. But at the same time, the three of us were like, sort of like, eh, it could work out. But we also, I think, also from following the Diamondbacks for many years, have a certain degree of nihilism about the team. It's like, eh, whatever happens, happens. Nick, I kind of want to get your sort of thoughts and rundown on the Diamondbacks offseason, and that can, you know, from the Greinke signing to the various trades to even the uniforms, because it just be good to probably have a perspective that wasn't just like, eh, it's fine.
I'll start off by saying that I like that the Diamondbacks are going for it, because as we all know, the core there is in place. There's Goldschmidt, there's AJ Pollock. You can throw Patrick Corbin in there, David Peralta even. I mean, the core is there. Both Goldschmidt and Pollock are older than the average. You know, let's build a team around these stars, guys. So, you know, you want to go for it with the window that they have, especially with the Dodgers coming up with, you know, every good prospect in the world in the next couple of years. You know, there's only so much time that they have to go for it. So I like that they're going for it. I don't like the manner in which they are going for it. I have no problem with the Greinke signing. You know, if you're going to kick off your going for it offseason by signing Zach Greinke, that's a good place to start. Diamondbacks needed to start pitching, as we all know. Because,
oh God, yes.
Because, you know, there's only so many starts you can give to, you know, insert guy here. You know, there's only so many starts you can give to Ruby De La Rosa and Zach Godley and those kind of guys.
Josh Colemanter seems like a great guy, but
yeah, Josh Colemanter, there we go. There's only so many starts you can give to Josh Colemanter, even Randall Delgado, if you, you know, want to throw him in the rotation. So Greinke's a good place to start. You need an ace. Greinke's an ace. He's one of the best in baseball. You know, that money is well spent. And this is where I run into problems. You referenced the taking of mescaline. That might have been what happened. I will say that as good as Dansby Swanson a prospect is, he might even be slightly overrated as a prospect because, I mean, he did go first overall, but Swanson was a value pick because the Diamondbacks wanted to save pool money. So instead of going with Brendan Rodgers first overall, who was likely the best prospect in the draft, they went with Swanson, one because he's a little bit cheaper and he's closer to the majors because he's a college guy instead of a high school guy like Brendan Rodgers. That being said, Dansby Swanson is a two-way shortstop, so, you know, he's very good. And then Aaron Blair is also pretty darn good and pretty close to the majors and could have been an important part of the pitching depth of this team. And, you know, Shelby Miller, and they lost under Enciarte too, who's also a very good player. And now all of a sudden you have to have Yasmani Tomas playing defense full time. So,
well, I will. Sorry to interrupt. I will say about Tomas, I don't know if you see any pictures of him lately. Is he in the best shape of his life? Like generally, yeah. Actually,
he's not huggable anymore.
Do we have a verifiable best shape of his life in Yasmani Tomas?
Hold on, I'm gonna search Twitter real quick. But he is noticeably thin.
So he's looking spry, is what you're saying?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Well, while you frantically Google that, let me ask you this, Nick. It's been a while since we've done anything. The high is honestly starting to go away. Which highly touted prospect should we dump next?
Well, you only have like two or three left, right?
I was gonna say, who's left on the list?
I mean, we've got Bradley, Shipley, and Drury, right? I mean, that's pretty much it. And there's a couple guys lower down in the lower levels, but they're not, you know, anywhere near close. I mean, you've got Richie Huang, and you know, you can maybe Yoan Lopez. We don't really know what he is yet.
Do you think we could move one of them to get like a Howie Kendrick sort of player?
Here's the thing: I wouldn't move Shipley or Bradley right now, purely because they are the next line of defense, especially with Blair out the window. I mean, Bradley's already on the 40-man, and he's also theoretically inherently talented, and that has to come to fruit at some point, you would think. And Shipley is, I would argue, probably a better bet than Archie Bradley at this point. You don't want to, if you're really going to be honest to God in the playoff run, you're hoping that one of those guys takes De La Rosa's place in the rotation at some point. And, you know, and we're also assuming that Robbie Ray continues to pitch well, by the way, which is not a given at all.
Oh, of course, yeah.
And, you know, even if they, both of those guys, you know, De La Rosa and Robbie Ray start pitching well, maybe you put Shipley in the bullpen for the stretch run. You know what I'm saying? Because, I mean, right now it's Ziegler or Clippard. You don't really know what Clippard's going to do for you, by the way, because he's got a little scary towards the end of the year. Those pop-ups are turning into fly balls, and that's an adventure in Arizona. And, you know, Hudson...
Oh, it'll be fine.
And, you know,
what could go wrong?
Yeah, Hudson's turned into a pretty decent reliever. Andrew Chafin's all right. But, you know, you probably want another guy out there with Ziegler, especially because Ziegler's kind of old. So, I mean, pitching depth is good, and I wouldn't move those guys. I mean, maybe you can move Brandon Drury, but at the same time, he's probably able to contribute in the big league at some point this year. And, you know, he's a middle infielder. And, you know, do you really want to put all your money on Nick Ahmed and Gene Segura in the middle infield for the whole year? Probably not.
Yeah, that's the thing with Drury is he could play second or third. So he could be, you know, Ahmed, Segura, Owings insurance. They could also be sort of Jake Lamb sophomore slump insurance as well.
Exactly. So, I mean,
so
all three of those guys are probably going to figure into the stretch run at some point. Now, in terms of Shelby Miller, in a vacuum, that's not a bad idea. I don't like what they paid for Shelby Miller. I mean, that's a lot to give up in a system that was already a little bit thin, and, you know, at the risk of being labeled a prospect hugger, which is probably one of the worst things you can commit on baseball Twitter, apparently.
you want to be like a prospect, like handshake.
Yeah, and you know, those are guys I wanted to keep. I would have wanted to keep if I was Diamondbacks fan. So, I mean, Shelby Miller in 2015, he pitched to a 3.02 ERA with a 3.45 FIP, which is decent, but if you look at the full season numbers, he kind of started falling apart a little bit towards the end of the year. Basically, they're hedging their bets on 2015 Shelby Miller showing up and not 2014 Shelby Miller showing up. And
I will say as a counterpoint that 2014 Shelby Miller probably would have been the best pitcher for the 2015 Diamondbacks other than Patrick Horton.
Well, I mean,
but that speaks more to how terrible the rotation was than anything.
2014 Shelby Miller, he of the 4.54 FIP.
My statement.
Yeah, that sounds good.
And the 6.2 strikeouts per nine. And now that, of course, is that, and because that Shelby Miller was pitching in St. Louis, he had a 3.74 ERA because of the defense in the deep park. Do you want to put 2014 Shelby Miller in Arizona? Probably not. That gets ugly. And, you know, as good a season as Sheldon Miller had, he's pretty much still a two-pitch guy with, you know, like the comings and goings of a third pitch here and then. And, you know, if he pitches well, Greinke, Corbin Miller is a pretty good place to start for a rotation on a team that's, that fancies itself a contender. That could also go south very quickly. So that is a very high-risk, high-reward trade. I don't like it. I mean, I again, adding Sheldon Miller to the Diamondbacks in a vacuum is pretty good. Paying what they paid for Sheldon Miller is, I don't know.
It could make the next 2 to 3 years better, but it could make the 5 to whatever years after that really
I mean,
better.
Honestly, this team is a 2 or 3 year window team at the best. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it depends on how long you want to bet on Greinke being Greinke, how long you think Corbin's elbow is going to hold up, if it holds up at all. Goldschmidt and Pollock are both 28, so they probably have 3 or 4 good years left of them before they start declining a little bit. I mean, Goldschmidt's an all-world talent, so he might hit until he's 37. And that would surprise me, but his speed's going to start going, and his speed is a fairly large part of his value as an offensive first baseman. David Peralta, also 28. So, not saying that, you know, sound the alarms, but there's a window here, especially with
the Dodgers having
nothing but youth coming up, and the Giants seem to pull good players out of their ass whenever they want. So, yeah, I don't know.
It's a relatively small window, so it has to hit pretty much within
and
a couple.
It also depends on how long ownership is willing to spend without a championship.
Well, I think there might be some leeway to that because TV money is starting to kick in
and a
this year.
Ton of it. They got a $50 million bonus.
But I mean, here's the thing. Once they graduate, let's say, you know, miraculously all three of Archie Bradley, Brandon Shipley, and Brandon Drury graduate and succeed in the Major League. That's awesome. Then what? Because, you know, there are theoretically guys in the lower levels who could break out, and they, you know, let's say theoretically you're winning games, at least the upper third of the league in terms of win totals, so you're not going to be getting the good draft picks and the sexy draft picks they've been getting recently. I mean, and, you know, you can't really count on Peter O'Brien and other guys like that, so there's a window here.
Well, and also going back to the idea of the window is that the TV money is really only going to help in the short term in the sense that a lot of other teams are getting lots of TV money or will soon.
Yeah.
You know, that bubble may burst at some point in the next 5 to 10 years, but at least now the teams that are getting on board with it are getting a ton of money. So everybody has lots of money to spend. So, you know, they can afford Greinke now, but they're probably not going to be able to do another type of that signing next year if they fall short, or the year after. It's pretty much, okay, well, we made our big splash. We've made some trades. We've got to hit it. And if it's not winning, you know, this year or next year, then some of these pieces might start getting shipped out and going through a Braves process.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, there is a scenario in which Patrick Corbin is moved at the 2016 trade deadline.
Yeah, definitely.
And that's not a fun thing to hear, of course. But I mean, There's a lot of onus being placed on, I mean, for now at least, because theoretically, Brandon Drury is the second baseman starting opening day 2016. But there's a lot of onus right now on Gene Segura, you know, finding another 3 months of being good at baseball inside of him, because he only has had 3 months of being good at baseball in the major league at the very least. And, you know, Nick Ahmed's got a good glove, but he doesn't hit. And, you know, Chris Owings magically remembering how to hit would be cool. But, you know, then there's a lot here.
Chris Owings definitely kind of confuses me, just emotionally. And, you know,
But
the guy just like raked all throughout the minors, and then was pretty good his first 2 months of call up in 2014. Got injured and just hasn't been able to figure it out since then.
It's always strange to me how much an injury sometimes will completely disrupt a player. Like, you almost wonder just how much of it is psychological to some degree. Like, if you get hurt, then you're a little more hesitant when you come in.
Well, what was his injury?
It was a shoulder injury because he heard it trying to hustle out trying to get the home plate on some meaningless 2014 game. So, you know, the lesson here, kids, is never try.
You don't have to say it was a meaningless 2014 game. I think all 2014 games were.
Touché. But, yeah, it was a shoulder injury, but, yeah, Owings was never going to be, like, you know, Rod Carew or anything, but he profiled as a guy who, kind of low OBP, but, you know, high average. A guy could sort of slot in as a secondary piece, but last year he just fell off.
I had him on my fantasy team to start the year. I was hoping that he would be a thing, and he wasn't.
I apologize for that.
So I have a question for you guys. Actually, I have a question for you guys.
Go for
Socrates
it.
Brito.
Best name in baseball.
Besides that.
Okay.
Is he a guy? I mean, is he the guy?
He was fairly well thought of. I mean, he wasn't like in the sort of Bradley Shipley, Drury range, but I guess sort of the level below that. But he's a guy who, he's left-handed, so, you know, the Diamondbacks are in dire need of anyone who could do that, because all they have in their starting lineup is Jake Lamb and David Peralta. He's very fast. He has decent defensively. Right now, he probably slots in as the fourth outfielder on this team. He basically is the Ender Inciarte replacement, both in like roster spot and kind of stylish, if that makes sense.
So he's the Yasmani Tomas insurance plan.
Yeah, basically. Yeah.
Okay.
either, however you want to look at it, either the Yasmani Tomas insurance plan or the guy who's probably getting bumped because we feel like we've given money to Yasmani Tomas, so we should stick with him.
Yeah, Yasmani Tomas, up until Greinke, was the largest contract in Diamondbacks history. And it was, I use air quotes here, only $60 million for Tomas. Yeah. Which, that was another, you know, big thing. We kind of talked about it on the last podcast, that one of the reasons the Greinke signing came out of nowhere is that, like, that is, like, more than three times as much money as the Diamondbacks have thrown at anyone ever. So, you know. It's a good thing Paul Goldschmidt signed a really, really, really cheap extension.
Yes.
I don't know how Kevin Towers was able to do that, but...
One good thing he's done.
Yeah, I think, you know, kind of to your general, what you're talking about, the window is sort of narrow, but it is more pried open. And I guess they have the similar thought like they did maybe in 2001, where it's like, okay, we won the whole thing, so now that we do that, maybe we have some goodwill for a few years, if there's some lean years. Of course, the Diamondbacks, not too long after 2001, fell hard.
So what you're saying is 2019 is not going to be good.
No, probably not even in a general sense either. You know, the world.
That's true. I'm kind of okay with making a big push and accepting that, you know what, in a few years it might suck, because I feel like with the way that the team, with the team and its market, we're not going to be one of those teams that the Diamondbacks are not going to be super competitive every year. That's just implausible. So sign Zach Greinke, make some big moves, and you know what? Yeah, I've already put up with terrible seasons out of teams I like for less reason than this, so I'm good. Let's go for it. That's basically my attitude coming into this season.
So sort of shifting gears here to our guest here. Nick, you are a Yankees fan. I'm not going to hold that against you, since you agreed to come on this podcast and are a very nice person. But, you know, our listenership, whoever it may not follow the Yankees closely or at all. How would you summarize, say, end of last season going into this season? You know, any moves they made, what are the expectations, what are some players to look out for, that sort of thing?
Last year ended with a spanking at the hands of Dallas Keuchel in the All-Star game, which was not fun. I was there. It wasn't fun. I mean, even just going into the night, I mean, Keiko had spanked them, I think, two or three times already that year. And they've never really hit Dallas Keuchel ever. So it wasn't a surprise when he just completely destroyed them in the All-Star game. It was kind of, there may be one or two hard hit balls the whole night. It was bad. But, you know, they were in the playoffs, so it was cool. But there were definitely changes that need to be made. It was obviously an old team. It still was an old team, but it's not as old. Part of the reason they struggled is because, I mean, they didn't have Mark Teixeira. Greg Bird came up and did amazing things, but the Mark Teixeira switch hitter and having him batting right-handed in that lineup would have made a big difference. So in terms of the offseason, I mean, they, as you might have heard, they did not sign a single major league free agent, which is the most un-Yankees thing you can possibly imagine.
It was kind of shocking. Yeah.
But that being said, I actually, from a pure baseball perspective, really like what they did this offseason. I like the Aaron Hicks trade. It was John Ryan Murphy, the backup catcher, to Minnesota for Aaron Hicks, who is a former top prospect, defensive wizard with a cannon for an arm. He's a switch hitter. There's offensive potential yet to be tapped in there. He started hitting a little bit this past year, so they're going to go to work and tinker with him, hopefully make him into something. He's going to be the fourth outfielder out the gate, with the idea that maybe he moves into a starting spot at some point down the road. The ideal situation here is a Carlos Gomez kind of thing, where he kind of steps away from Minnesota and gets awesome. The tools are there. He's got some power. So we'll see what happens there. They also traded for Starlin Castro, Adam Warren to the Cubs. For Starlin Castro, he's going to be the second baseman. He's going to be pretty much the first good second baseman they've had since Cano left.
I was going to say, I do feel, as a Diamondbacks fan, that I kind of just want to be like, Stephen Drew, sorry. He was pretty good when we had him. We liked him, but it seemed to have gone downhill for him.
Yeah.
Well, there's another guy kind of talking about injuries derailing.
It wasn't even an injury. It was him holding out after 2013 in the offseason, because he was given Kendrys Morales, had qualifying offers, and...
Well, it started in 2011 because he got his ankle blown out.
Right, but I mean, in 2012 and 2013, he was actually pretty productive. I mean, he was a starting shortstop for the Red Sox when they won the World Series, and he had a pretty decent year. I mean, after he held out, it just kind of all collapsed, and it never got better. And now he's Washington's problem, so that's fine. So it's Starlin Castro at second. He's also Didi's backup at short. And they're going to try him out at third a little bit too. The idea is to kind of make him into a super utility kind of guy, a little bit of a built-in bench, which is awesome. Obviously, Castro's got the tools. He's almost at 1,000 hits already. He's only 26. A little bit of a downturn the past couple of years, but again, he showed some. There was some light at the end of the tunnel after he moved to second base last year with the Cubs. So if that could continue, that would be awesome. And then obviously the third move is Aroldis Chapman. From a pure baseball perspective, that was a great move that gave them the Royals on crack bullpen, between Sam Miller. From a I'm a human being perspective, it felt really dirty and awful.
Taking advantage of the fact
that he beat the crap out of his girlfriend and intimidated her by shooting a gun a million times in the house. And that plays. That's why his trade value was as low as it was, and you know, now he's suspended for 30 games.
Did the Dodgers ever come out and say that's why we ended up not trading for him?
I believe they actually did. Yeah, I think somebody from the Dodgers. I think it was either Zaidi or Freeman. I think it was Zaidi who went on the record and said that's why we didn't do it. I was pretty grumpy when that happened. I wrote a pretty scathing thing for BP Bronx when that happened. Like I said, from a pure baseball perspective, it's a brilliant move. You acquire him, you have a super bullpen for you, you stick the qualifying offer on him and collect the draft pick when he's gone. So, awesome, but, you know, at the same time, I don't like that he's on my team. So, that's going to be a weird situation all year for me personally. In terms of outlook for this season, a little bit of bump in the road when Greg Bird went down for the year with a torn labrum in his shoulder. He was the Mark Teixeira insurance plan. also kind of the A-Rod insurance plan, because either if Teixeira got hurt, he'd come up to play first base. If A-Rod got hurt, Teixeira becomes the DH, and he comes up plays first. He's out for the year, and we all saw how kick-ass he was in 2015. And it just kind of always hurts when the shining prospect kid goes down with an injury, and it sucks. But, I mean, there's a lot of things that could go really well for this team, a lot of things that can go awful for this team. I mean, if the pitching stays healthy, it's going to be really good. Tanaka is Tanaka. Pineda has shown some really good signs in the past. Nate Eovaldi turned into a really good pitcher in the second half before he had a forearm strain. He started really using that splitter, and he got freakishly nasty. Severino has got all the potential in the world. And, you know, what the fifth starter spot is going to be, some of the amalgamation of CC Sabathia and Ivan Nova and whoever else comes up. And, you know, that whether that is what it is, whatever.
That sounds like just a Frankenstein project. That terror to behold.
If CC's bionic knee brace keeps working for him, then he's going to be a productive back-end starter. So that works for me. And there's a couple kids kicking around towards the top of the minors who could come up theoretically at some point and provide innings.
It kind of depends if they manage to get Tony Stark on the phone to work on the bionic.
Yeah. I mean, that being said, the pitching could also all just go up in flames and die and be terrible. You know, A-Rod and Teixeira could spend the entire year on the DL while Beltran never gets hurt but is rotting and useless in the outfield. And, you know, Gardner's already on the shelf a little bit, but he's not going to be playing into the middle of March because he has a bone bruise on his wrist from the wild card game. That is still an issue, apparently.
Wow.
And, you know, you hope Jacoby Ellsbury is fully healthy because he was awesome until he hurt his knee, and then he sucked for the rest of the year. So you hope that works. And, you know, we'll see. This team could kick ass and win the division. They could be awful and bottom out, or it could be kind of and take third place. So I don't know.
Well, I think the AL East lately, and there seems to be no reason to think it'll be different this year, kind of has just been kind of all over the damn place.
Yeah.
So I mean, that could either help or hinder, because, you know, you could run into a situation where it's like, oh, wow, the people the Orioles actually signed because they passed the rigorous CrossFit examination and actually work out.
I think the Orioles are going to suck, actually. But, yeah. But, I mean, the Orioles...
The Orioles are the current placeholders of Mark Trumbo. You Diamondbacks fans. Here's the thing about Mark Trumbo. I noticed this earlier. Kevin Towers traded for him, got fired a few months later. Jack Z traded for him in Seattle, got fired a few months later. Daniel Kent kind of better watch his ass right now.
He's on the hot seat now.
Wow. I never even picked up on that before. Oh my god, that's funny. I never picked up.
Yeah, he is. He's a toxic asset.
No. Yeah, I mean, the Orioles are the only team in this division right now where I look at them and say, "You guys aren't going to win the division." The Rays have a pretty good outside shot, I think. The Red Sox, they had one of their prototypical flashy off-seasons. We'll see if it actually works. Because, I mean, they also have a Super Bowl pen now with Kimbrel and Carson Smith back there. But, I mean, they signed David Price, and, you know, that was kind of it. And they signed Chris Young to be on the bench, and that's it. It's pretty much the same team as last year, and plus David Price and a couple of relievers. And, you know, what they were like...
What they were lacking
last year was an ace and a few relievers, so we'll see, but I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Red Sox seem to be not like a direct mirror, a vague American League mirror of the Diamondbacks, in the sense that they did sort of a similar thing. They were a sort of A-team that sort of vaulted themselves in discussion by signing a really good pitcher.
I mean, the thing about the Red Sox is also, you know, unlike the Diamondbacks, I mean, they've got young talent, and they've got a lot more coming up. Like, they got Mookie, they got Xander Bogaerts. Hopefully moving Hanley to first base mitigates some of the bad stuff that was out of there with his defense, so he has freedom to hit. Pablo Sandoval's probably not going to be as bad as you would think. Maybe Rick Porcello comes back. They got a full suit of Eduardo Rodriguez to look forward. They have Joe Kelly and his great stuff.
Yes, you wrote about that today.
In fact, have great stuff. I have numerical evidence for it. And the great stuff might actually be the problem with Joe Kelly. Because all of his pitches move so damn much, you just can't put them where he wants it.
I guess the question that I was attempting to jump in at different points was... you kind of briefly touched on it from your perspective, but I wanted to kind of get a temperature check based on what maybe you know with other Yankees fans, their perspective on how their off seasons used to be, the prime A type of off season, and then it's become increasingly quiet. Where this off season, they definitely were overshadowed even by teams like the Diamondbacks. After going after these big free agents, so is that something that the fan base is actually kind of welcoming at this point, or are people getting impatient?
Yes and no. The Chapman acquisition was a sexy "quote unquote" acquisition. He's a big marquee name. He's got the 100-mile-an-hour fastball, and the Super Bowl pen is in vogue right now. So the Aroldis Chapman acquisition kind of placated some people. Castro is also a bit of a household name. He's young and, he's had success in the past, so people like that. The second base has been an issue in the past few years. But they also, what also is happening with the Yankees for the first time in a while is that they have prospects that are worth getting excited about, and they're at the upper levels, like Aaron Judge. Gary Sanchez, the catcher, is going to play a large role in the coming season, kind of as Brian McCann's protege, backup kind of guy. He's a good hitting catcher, improving on defense a lot. He's going to slug. And Judge, Judge is also just, he's you look at him and he's kind of, Blake Griffin with a bat in his hand, which, it looks good on TV, obviously. And then there's Jorge Mateo kicking around the lower leagues. Like I said, Greg Bird, he's out for the year, but, people got excited about Greg Bird. So there is young talent in this system for the first time in a while, and people are excited about that. And people have, a lot of what I hear on the radio shows, like when people call him about the Yankees on Mike Francesa's show, it's a lot of it is about when's Aaron Judge coming up, when is Jorge Mateo coming up, all that good stuff. They're not screaming about why. There were people screaming, why didn't we sign Greinke? Why didn't we sign Johnny Cueto? Why didn't we sign all X, Y, and Z? Every team's gonna with money is gonna be wondering why they didn't sign those guys when it happens. But I think people also realize there really wasn't a place to put these pitchers. Based on the way the roster is constructed, because a lot of the slots on the roster are just locked in. You can't move some of these contracts. You have players that are locked in at different positions, and there's not a whole lot of flexibility that Brian Cashman had to work with. So all things considered, they weren't totally up in arms, but at the same time, it is definitely a transition period, not only just for the frame of mind of the Yankees fan about, okay, we're going to go out and sign every single person in the world and we're going to kick ass. It's that there's nowhere to put these guys, and Brian Cashman is also trying to transition to a built-from-within kind of strategy.
Yeah, I was going to say, you guys still have a lot of, even though the Yankees have more money than they got, you still have a lot of money tied up in, like, Ellsbury, Sabathia, Beltran, probably some other guys, yeah. So, yeah, that's, financial prudence. Who'd have thunk?
These guys make a lot of money. Let's say Ellsbury and Gardner are helping us get good years. It goes a long way. Are you expecting Teixeira and A-Rod to have standout offseason? Because both Teixeira and A-Rod were excellent last year. They were absolutely excellent. Does that happen again? Probably not. But, I expect good things from them. So we'll see.
Nick, I don't know where you live. I don't know if you're in New York. So if you really deal with the with Yankee Stadium,
if you could please give us your address.
I'm in Jersey.
Okay.
I go to the stadium.
Okay. So my question was, because I know that there's been a lot of kind of people upset with. Hold on, let me rephrase this question in my mind. So, let me stall for a second so Charlie can edit this part out later. I'm making you do your job, editor.
Keep that in.
Yeah, keep that part. No, I feel like the Yankees, ever since they got the new stadium, it seems like there's been at least somewhat of an uproar kind of on the internet with dealing with the new stadium and kind of the way people feeling like the higher price tickets are getting treated differently than the people who are paying lower prices. Also, this season, this off season, they announced that they wouldn't be accepting printed home tickets anymore. Do you feel like there's kind of a disconnect between the different levels of? I don't want to put it exactly as like a class divide in Yankees fans.
It totally is.
Is it okay? I was saying, is that something that's legitimate, or is it just something that's kind of blown out of proportion on the internet?
I don't know how visible it is on the visiting team's broadcasts or national broadcasts, but there is literally a moat between the super high-end seats around the edge of the infield and the box seats. Like, there is literally a tall...
It's definitely visible.
There is a concrete wall.
Yeah.
And there's a story from the year that the stadium opened, actually. It was a really hot day, I think in, like, July or August. It was the first year the stadium was open. It was like 100 degrees out. It was a day game. And a lot of the people, because when you have those seats, there's like an indoor buffet area that you have access to, which is why those seats always look like they're empty. They're not selling the tickets. People are inside eating. So everybody was hiding inside in the air conditioning. And I forget who it was. I think it was the hospitality director or the market. I forget who it was, the marketing director or somebody. But what happened was that they coax people outside by offering them ice cream sandwiches. Now, the people in the box seats on the other side of the moat are like, okay, where the hell is our ice cream?
I just have to say that I'm personally envisioning this as them standing outside. Come on, do you want an ice cream sandwich? Just to like lure them out like a puppy.
But now you also add in angry people with New York accents.
Okay, excellent. This is even better.
Okay, so the people out on the other side of the moat are wondering where the hell their ice cream is. And so some people from inside the moat start tossing ice cream sandwiches out to people in the box seats. The guy who would mastermind of the ice cream thing was kind of pissed off now because people on the other side of the moat were getting their ice cream and they weren't supposed to be getting ice cream. So there was a miniature riot, basically.
This is like 75% of how the French Revolution started, I think.
It's like the Jesus Montero incident on crack.
Yeah, it's like when they reboot Les Miserables in 10 years, that'll be
the Hugh Jackman's gonna play Derek Jeter. So that basically is the new Yankee Stadium in a nutshell. From the exterior, it is a beautiful building. Even on the inside, it's a beautiful building. And the field itself is very nice. If you look around, when you're sitting in your seat, you look around the stadium, it's pretty. And that's about it. Because it's a shopping mall. It is absolutely a shopping mall. I'll get over Mike Francesa again. Mike Francesa phrased it best a couple of days ago. It's not a ballpark. It's a stadium. It doesn't feel cozy. I've been going to Yankee Stadium for a while. I have a partial season ticket plan out in the bleachers, actually. And I've actually had done a couple games in the box seats on the field level, and I actually prefer my bleacher seats better because it's a better view, and I just like it better. Mm-hmm. But I went to a game at Citi Field for the first time, and it was the most drastically different feeling that you can possibly imagine. Citi Field is cozy, even though it's literally a bigger field. Citi is a lot cozier. It feels like you're at a ball game. It feels like you're there to have fun and kick back and enjoy yourself. Yankee Stadium is very cold, very corporate. Even the concessions they offer like sushi and stuff like that. I don't necessarily mind that, but you can just see how it's tailored to a certain demographic. And it's just like they built the ballpark and they want to put butts in seats and that's it. There's a lot of ballparks have like between inning fun. I mean, there's a couple of goofy things that happen on the Jumbotron between innings at Yankee Stadium. But if you go to two games, you've seen all the goofy things in the Jumbotron. There's something new, something exciting, something fun. There's no mascot race. There's no anything. Even at Citi Field, there's a couple of stupid little things that happen between innings, and it's fun. I mean, there's Sweet Caroline or whatever, that's stupid, but it is what it is. And, you know, Yankee Stadium, it's cold. There's no fun vibe in it. And to be perfectly honest, there's Yankee fans in Yankee Stadium. I mean, a large part of what I wrote about the wild card game after I came out of the wild card game, with the frame of mind that I was still pissed about everything that happened, a lot of what I wrote about the wild card game wasn't what happened on the field. It was the fans. I mean, it was just the absolute venom that was being spewed around me. It was horrifying. I mean, just the things people were saying about the players. You know, I literally heard people saying, "If the boss was still here," that's like a stereotype you hear on a lot. I literally heard people saying that. It blew my mind. And not to dump on Yankees fans, and people get angry on Twitter, but
it's okay. Like, three people listen to this, and two of them are related to me.
but I mean, Yankee Stadium, it is what it is. And a lot we're saying that people are getting priced out. That's absolutely true. That's one of the big gripes a lot of fans have. I mean, the neighborhood Yankee Stadium is in the Bronx is it's not, you know, it's, I don't want to say it's a rough neighborhood, but it's not exactly the highest income area in the world. And you know, those people aren't going to the games. It's not like, you know, you should be drawing your fans immediately from the immediate area, but if you want to go to Yankee Stadium and not sit in the bleachers, you need to set aside a little bit of money. And there's people being priced out. It's not fun.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank
you. Yeah, that's very insightful. And on a few questions, this comes from Snake Pit member Asteroid in the spring training game thread. I asked for questions, and she asks, I don't know if we've answered this before because this seems in our wheelhouse, but this would also be a good question for Nick. What's your favorite baseball book, either nonfiction or fiction or both?
Ooh.
Whoever wants to.
Actually, I'm just going to say it's actually kind of timely that Nick is here, because one of my favorite baseball books, and I'm going to frantically Google because I don't remember who wrote it, but it was a book that I bought like at a library book sale like years ago, and it's called The Year I Owned the Yankees by Sparky Lyle. And it's like it's a fantasy. It's not like fantasy, but it's like it's kind of a satire, and it's ridiculous, and it was just really hilarious. Yeah, it's fiction.
Okay, because Sparky Lyle was a closer for the Yankees for a while.
Yeah. So basically, the premise is that the team, for some reason, oh no, that's what it is. It's like a fantasy. They've managed. It's set in 1990. They've managed to get rid of Steinbrenner, and they go to Sparky Lyle as somebody who's like representative of the old Yankees. And it's a really funny book, I thought.
Awesome.
But yeah,
that's really funny, actually. Wow, I've never heard that before.
Zoko, you got Ooh. One?
Yeah, I know. That's the problem, though, is that there's a lot of baseball books that I really enjoy that I think are really good. So, probably one. I mean, the first one that probably jumped to mind would be The Boys of Summer. Not that I'm old enough to be a Brooklyn Dodgers fan or really have any particular nostalgia for that era or those teams, but especially the first half of it, because it's basically a story of the writer used to be a beat writer for the Dodgers, and then I believe the Yankees after that, before writing at Newsweek, and then he went to Sports Illustrated at one point as well. But he was a beat writer, and he knew the players and everything, so like the first half of it is more like how he got into baseball as a kid, and his parents were Orthodox Jews, and they didn't really understand what he was getting himself into, and they didn't. It was just the first part is really funny, especially if you're Jewish. So the second half is more kind of is also interesting in the sense that he went and tracked down a bunch of the old Dodgers players from the 50s, like 20 years later, and just looked up what they were doing, and then kind of had them reminisce, but. The first part's really funny, and the second part's really interesting to get their perspective, so it's a different kind of baseball book than a lot of them, because it's not just a sort of blow by blow, this is what happened in the season or someone's career. But it kind of covers a lot of different angles that I think fans would appreciate.
I actually haven't read a whole lot of baseball books. I just haven't had the time. So this is going to be pretty boring selection, but I'm going to have to go with Moneyball. Not because I read it at the Sabermetrics site. Actually, the more interesting parts of Moneyball, not how they built the A's, it's more, because a large portion of Moneyball is devoted to Billy Beane's journey through the minor leagues as a player and the process of him getting drafted and all that stuff. And look at how traditional scouting sometimes fails players because they didn't get who Billy Beane was as a player and who he was as a person. And looking at how Billy Beane's playing career affects his GM career and how he goes about building the A's with Paul DePodesta is fascinating. It's really interesting stuff. I mean, for me, that part of Moneyball is infinitely more interesting than the actual building of the Oakland A's and the Moneyball draft and stuff like that. And I think it alternates back and forth. Like, one chapter's about the A's, and one goes back to Billy Beane as a player, and it goes back and forth. It's really good stuff. I mean, it's a best-selling, timeless book for a reason. It's also good to read just so you don't misuse the term Moneyball ever again. And it's a really good read. I mean, you have to take everything with a grain of salt and realize that Billy Beane's kind of an asshole. But it's really good stuff. I mean, it was fascinating to me.
For me, there's not a lot of books I've read. This is kind of a recent one. The one John Curry wrote about the Expos, Up, Up, and Away. Yeah, I checked it out from the library like a few months ago, and I read it like cover to cover pretty quickly. But I have a sort of weird interest in sort of defunct sports teams, so that was interesting. And just we talked about it on an episode of this podcast last year, I remember clearly, but just the history of the Expos is fascinating, not just because as a baseball history, just because their history is just so unique. From, turning a park into their first stadium, or just their sort of French-Canadian flair and, how it all went to shit, thanks Jeffrey Loria. But, that's probably the most recent baseball book I read, but it's also a really good one. Let's get to another question. Where was it? This is from, this is from Twitter user Jim Bishop at Mr. Murby. Is Talking Stick really a country club? If so, is it open to both sexes? Now, background, Troy Tulowitzki, who is, I would guess, 75% of this panel is one of their least favorite players, or maybe even 100% because he plays for the Blue Jays now. But he basically said that whatever Florida spring training they were doing was like real baseball, and that excuse me, Talking Stick was a country club. I'm paraphrasing.
Is that why people were talking
about
you on Twitter a couple days ago? Oh, I totally missed that. Okay.
Yes.
I guess I don't understand why people are really upset about that comment, and then B, why it would be a bad thing to be a country club.
I think there's some, in the sort of masculine sports exclamation point sphere, there's a little bit of like, you have to, train the gulag in 100 degree weather because
in that same realm, did Troy Tulowitzki like pull a muscle while making that comment? Because he's not the most durable player of all time.
I don't think that's really relevant. I mean, that sounds like Tulo just being resentful of the Rockies, and for good reason. They kind of treated him like crap and jerked him around a lot. And I don't fault anybody for having negative feelings towards the Rockies, especially former Rockies players.
Yeah, that goes around.
Tulo has every right to want to trash the Rockies, and good for Tulo, I guess. I mean, it kind of plays into what Charlie was talking about, the masculine sports thing. You know, we want to train at a training facility, not share space with a resort, like apparently Talking Stick is, but, you know,
not really. I mean,
the casino's on the other side of the
disclaimer. Yeah, full disclaimer. I work in an office building across the street from it, so I'm pretty familiar with that area. Yeah, and the hotel resort is across the freeway, so it's a couple miles away. You can certainly see it from certain parts of the park, but it's not like the hotel's attached to it. That would be sweet because there's a casino
also
in it.
Also, I found an article, and it's not so much that he's saying that the facility is a country club. He's talking about the atmosphere of the Rockies spring training, which I can understand that. Taking
more interested in relaxing than playing baseball.
They did go straight from High Corbin to Tucson, which pre University of Arizona renovations, to Talking Stick, which is basically like
talk about,
you know, going
hole
to stabby. Stabby in off the freeway to, you know, like a four-star hotel.
I believe that Stalin, while establishing those gulags, did look at High Corbett and think, no, this is too far. We'll just put him in Siberia instead of Tucson. Come on, guys, let's have some hearts.
You know, there may have been a little of that. Like I said, High Corbett's nice just now, but that's because the university renovated it, and you know, I am very predisposed to still not like Troy Tulowitzki, even though he doesn't play for a team I hate anymore. So
I think it's just one of those things that you got to take with a huge grain of salt because it doesn't really mean anything. Yeah, he's bitter at his old team the same way like Gerardo Parra, when he signed with the Rockies, he said something to the effect of, "I'm excited to play here because, you know, the fans actually come out and just like throwing essentially shade at both the Brewers and the Diamondbacks." Like, Rockies don't always have that great of attendance. So I think at that point it's more probably just his sort of bitterness towards those other teams as opposed to anything inherently amazing about the Rockies, let alone anything inherently playing about BFE Florida for the Grapefruit League.
I guess somebody likes spending his sit down riding buses to the next game.
Hey, you know, gives you time to think and crochet or something. One last question. I'm pulling from three different things because I tweeted about it. I made a Facebook status and I posted it on the website, so I'll grab one from Facebook. Someone who is related to someone on this podcast has a bunch of questions, but I'm going to pull one because it's the funniest one, which is, what's Mark Grace doing? And I assume
Mark Grace doing right now?
I'd put good money on the fact that he's drinking a beer at this moment.
Yeah, seems reasonable.
Hopefully he's got
I think it's a good chance that he is asking somebody at a GGIF somewhere if they've ever been to a Turkish prison.
I have a good friend who works at this sort of hoity-toity steakhouse as much as one can be in Tucson. But, you know, when, you know, there were three teams doing spring training down here, players would come in because, you know, I guess it was the best game in town or something, or it was well-known, whatever. But he has a bunch of interesting stories, including the one where someone we still can't identify, but I thought for the longest time was Brian Price, was drunk and racist. But, now after last year's Brian Price, it's like, yeah, maybe. But, I guess, like, you know, Mark Grace and I guess his wife were known for just slamming actual, like, whole bottles of wine at the bar there, which is, like, that's intense for me, because wine drunk is...
So, in terms of what Mark Grace is doing at this very moment, I'm going to say interpretive dance.
It could be. He's at one of those hoity-toity Scottsdale clubs. And
no, like that scene from The Big Lebowski where the neighbors are in the dance recital.
Mm.
Yeah. I mean, he's certainly an odd duck. I mean, him being a color announcer for a decade or so was a.
I'm just gonna sum up all of our answers into one. And whatever Mark Grace is doing right now, he's probably just enjoying life.
Yeah, Mark Grace is Mark Grace. As long as he's
the Mark Grace abides.
Yes, the Mark Grace abides. So yeah, that's a good place as any to wrap up. I want to thank Nick again for being on the podcast. Again, being our first guest at our second season.
Feel free to put that on your resume.
I'm hopefully... Yes. I'm hoping to get another one next week. I won't reveal who because I have a solid lead as to who it is, but, you know, things could happen. But you can follow Nick on Twitter at Stellini Tweets. STELLINI Tweets. His avatar is Nate Uvalde, so... Or I should say, no, that's totally him.
Yeah, I am Nate Uvalde, actually. I am Nate Uvalde.
So, yeah, this is actually a really good get. It's not a player for the team we cover, but
take what we can get.
Vacuum, yeah. It's... Yeah, exactly.